Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. For today's episode, I had the honor and the privilege of sitting down with someone who has been the driving force behind some of the most important breakthroughs in the UFO disclosure movement, journalist and author Leslie Kane. Along with journalists Ralph Blumenthal and Helene Cooper, Kane is responsible for the now historic 2017 article in the New York Times entitled "Glowing Auras and Black Money: The Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program," that first revealed the existence of that program to the public. And in June of 2023, she teamed up with Ralph Blumenthal once again for another history-making piece in The Debrief about the stunning claims made by high-ranking intelligence official-turned-whistleblower David Grush about the existence of secretive crash retrieval programs that are in possession of craft of non-human origin. Just those two articles alone are enough to earn her an unchallenged spot on the Mount Rushmore of disclosure, but they hardly represent the totality of her work in the field. On top of writing countless articles, Leslie is also the author of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, as well as the book Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife. She also recently served as a producer for the phenomenal docuseries UFOs Investigating the Unknown. I'll have all of that and more linked up in the episode description so that you can check it out. Later this week, on December 9th, Leslie will be co-hosting the fourth meeting of the Inquiry into Anomalous Experience and the Phenomenon conference series in New York City alongside organizer J. Christopher King and James Ian Doley. Speakers include Diana Walsh-Pasulka, Tim Gallaudet, Michael Masters, Paul H. Smith, Peter Skafish, and Josh Cutchin. A surprise guest speaker was also just announced as well, pilot and Nimitz incident witness Alex Dietrich. In-person tickets for this conference are currently sold out, but a limited number of live stream tickets are still available. The link is in the episode description. I will be in New York City for the conference, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I couldn't be more excited to share that the new media company that I just launched with my co-conspirators J. Christopher King and Jordan Flowers on Talkalypse Productions will be dropping the first trailer for our new docuseries, The Beyond, UFOs and a New Reality, at the conference. I can't wait to share with you guys what we've been working on. And just one more quick note before we begin. Leslie and I recorded this conversation on Sunday, December 3rd, and this is going to be released at midnight on Tuesday, December 5th. And in the last 48 hours, a lot has happened with the Schumer Amendment, which is something that we do talk about in this episode. The points that were made, I still feel are really salient and relevant, and so I left the conversation as is. But if you want the latest up-to-date information about what's going on with the Schumer Amendment, just know that this episode, although it's brand new, is already slightly out of date in that respect. UFO world moves fast. All right, without further ado, here is my interview with the legendary Leslie Kane. So between the 2017 New York Times article and this year's article in The Debrief, Breaking the Grush Story, you've now been part in breaking the two biggest bombshell stories in what has become the disclosure movement. After these last 6 years and the decades of work that you've done on this subject, what are your thoughts about how far we've come and how far we still have to go?
Well, I think we've come really far, Kelly. I mean, I worked on this topic as a reporter for 17 years before the New York Times story came out in 2017. And the difference is like night and day. I mean, nothing was happening before that. I know that everybody always wants more, but when you look back at what it was like before that, and I was deeply involved in this as a reporter from starting in 2000. So I spent 17 years doing the best reporting I could in the most credible way all those years. And then this New York Times story happens, and it just is like flipping a light switch. I mean, it's been completely different. And the amount of things that have happened since then, when you just look back over these last years, and see this snowball effect of that story and all the developments that have happened in Congress and with the various renditions of the task force and the legislation and all the political figures that have spoken out about this. There's just so much that's happened. It's almost hard to keep up with it. So I'm very pleased about what's happened. I think it's been an incredible amount of great stuff. And I think we're going to continue along those lines. I mean, we're going to have setbacks. We don't know what's going to happen now with this mess in Congress, you know, with the Schumer legislation and the House versions of it, and what's going to be cut and is it going to be killed? And there's so much back and forth about all of that. I don't think we quite know how it's going to end up yet, but that's going to have a big effect on where we go next. But even if we have a setback from that, there's no stopping this train. This train has left the station. It's going to keep going. People will be even more motivated. If there is a setback, it kind of fuels the flames a bit more and people get more motivated to take action. So I just expect it to continue the way it's been going until we gradually disclose more and more. And I'm just very pleased with how things have gone since 2017.
Absolutely. And jumping into kind of the topic of the hour that everyone's so excited about right now, or maybe excited is the wrong word. Some of us are in despair, but, you know, people do seem to be really concerned about what's going to happen with this Schumer legislation if it doesn't get passed, or if it doesn't get passed in a workable form. It sounds like you have reason to be optimistic, kind of regardless of how that goes. Can you give people an idea of what the path forward would look like if we do kind of have that worst case scenario with the Schumer legislation?
Yeah. So you're talking about, like, if we don't get anything. I'm hopeful that maybe we're going to get something out of that legislation. But even if we don't, I mean, what we have going is just too powerful to stop. That's the way I look at it. And there will be other opportunities for legislation, if not this specific one, something else. There will continue to be congressional hearings. There will continue to be whistleblowers coming forward, I hope. We already know that there are a lot of whistleblowers who have spoken to Congress. And there will be developments that will continue to happen. So I'm always pretty optimistic in my outlook on this. I think partly because I spent 17 years in such a different universe than we are in now. And I just think people shouldn't lose hope if the legislation doesn't pass. There's just so many pressures to bear. There's so many other elements of the disclosure process that can make change other than just congressional legislation. And the members of Congress that are behind this, I think they will continue to work on it and they will continue to press for hearings and things will happen. So we just have to all keep moving forward. I think that's the best way to look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. A question that I hear all the time is, you know, where are the other whistleblowers? We have these indications that these other whistleblowers exist, that they're out there, that some of them have even spoken to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Do you get the sense that whistleblowers are holding back to see what happens with this legislation, or are there more complex things happening behind the scenes? Why do you think it is that they haven't been able to step forward yet?
Yeah, I think there's a range of reasons, and I have talked to a number of them myself, and I can reiterate the fact that you said about them having spoken to Congress. I know for a fact that quite a few of them have spoken to at least staffers with Congress, and their data has been submitted to the Congress. And I think for each whistleblower, they have their own reasons for not wanting to come forward, but I think the sort of larger issues have to do with fears. A lot of it has to do with their jobs. We have to remember that David Grush had left government before he came forward. And the ones that are still in government or might be in private industry are there. They may not be permitted to talk to media or to come forward publicly, or they may choose not to because there's a risk that it could affect their careers and their jobs and they can't afford that. So there's that. I think that's a big concern for a lot of them. A lot of them who are working behind the scenes, really helping, are concerned that if they're public, it might hinder their ability to work behind the scenes, that maybe the people they're working with wouldn't want them to go public. There's also concerns about just threats and retributions and safety issues beyond just job safety, personal safety. If you look back, you know, David Grush suffered a lot of those kinds of effects. I don't know if that would happen again after David's been so public about it, but I suspect it easily could. Where the powers in control of this who don't want it to become public will threaten or harm people who have spoken out or might speak out. And I'm sure that some of those whistleblowers have received those kinds of warnings. You know, it could be subtle warnings that they get, or maybe not so subtle. So I think those are some of the reasons. And it may be that, particularly if the legislation does not pass, it may be that some of them will decide to come forward as a way of helping this process move when we don't have the legislation. I just don't know. But I understand completely from the people that I've talked to why they have this concern. And it's usually for very good reasons, as far as they're concerned. They're not just being timid or something. You know, they're doing as much as they possibly can to help. And they have good reasons for not wanting to be public with it at this point.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm always a little shocked sometimes with the kind of cavalier way that certain people approach this topic, as though, like, well, if I was a whistleblower, you know, I would have no problem putting my career and my family and my friends and everything in my life at risk.
Or maybe risking jail too, right? Yeah, I'd risk jail, you know? I don't think it's that simple. I mean, that's a lot of it too, Kelly. I mean, people say, why didn't they just come out with the classified information? You know, the penalties for that are severe. It's not like back in the days of the Pentagon Papers where it was just a different world, and the penalties would be severe for anybody crossing that line into the classified world and bringing it forward. And that's another concern. And I do think you're right that people tend to be a little bit too flip about what people aren't doing rather than focusing on what they are doing and the risks that people are taking. And to know that behind the scenes, so much is going on that we don't know about. You know, that's where a lot of what's happening goes on. And it's not that there aren't these very good patriotic people really working on this, because there are. And so I just think we all have to respect that they have to make their own choices about how they're going to go about it. And they have families and they have to make a living. So yeah, we have to be respectful of them.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's been really surprising for a lot of people how difficult it has been to get the mainstream media to really take a bite out of this story in any significant way. What do you think is behind that sort of push from media outlets who are just not being willing to really look at this? Do you think it just has to do with the stigma, or do you think there's something larger at play?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, again, I feel that the media is doing a lot more than they did before 2017. I mean, we just had Meet the Press spend 25 minutes talking about this. But I know that people are unhappy that, you know, why aren't the best journalists in the world in the investigative reporters just jumping all over this? And now I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, there definitely is still a stigma. There also are members of the intelligence community and the Pentagon defense establishment that have influence over some of the media. There are journalists who have developed sources over a long period of time. Within the intelligence community, they don't want to lose those sources. Those sources may not be in favor of them reporting on this. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on in terms of our big mainstream reporters where they're influenced by forces like that. Their editors have a role in what happens. And I think a lot of the issue too is, and I know this from when I was working on the David Gresh story before we put it out in the debrief, that there's all this concern about not having documentation or photographs or people on the record within Congress and all the kind of high level so-called proof or close to proof that media likes to have before they report a story. They just want it to be very, very, very well backed up. And especially when you're talking about something as out there as crash retrievals, you know, that's a big, big claim. And it's just a hard story for a mainstream newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post to cover without something more than the 40 people that Gresh spoke to. For them, that's not enough. For me, it's more than enough. Mm-hmm. And because I respect so highly who David Gresh is and what his background is and all of that, plus I respect highly the people that he spoke to, some of whom I was able to speak to. So it is mystifying to me on one level that these mainstream papers wouldn't run with that story. It's also understandable to me because I know how they operate and I've worked with them for so long. So I kind of see it through both lenses. And, you know, if Gresh had had documentation or something, it probably would have made a difference for that story. But, you know, the New York Times was good prior to, New York Times did a lot of stories with Ralph Blumenthal and I and Helene Cooper. And not just the one you mentioned that was the big one in 2017, but another really big one was the 2019 story where we talked about Ryan Graves, where he was our main voice. And we talked about the sightings off the East Coast of the United States, which affected his unit and his aircraft. And that story was also very, very impactful and got a lot of views, if not more than the first story did. So, you know, the New York Times did a whole series with us. And then it's just gotten to be kind of it's gone too far for them, I think. And they're now putting their own reporter on this, Julian Barnes, who doesn't have the kind of background and knowledge that Ralph and I do. So they're different kinds of stories than you might get from us. So I think there's a sort of a backing off now that we've gone into the realm of crash retrievals and that we don't have enough of the kind of documentation that they want for them to accept that that could be a legitimate news story. And that's what it boils down to. And the influences, like I said, that they might have from elements outside of the newspaper that they rely on, that they need to keep on their Rolodex in order to continue doing their work.
That makes a lot of sense. So it sounds like then what we're really looking for is if we can get some version of the Schumer Amendment passed, that that could potentially lay the groundwork for the release of some of that documentation in the future, right? So that then potentially the mainstream media might feel a little more comfortable pursuing this story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point because, you know, we've got that panel that the Schumer Amendment wants to set up, which would be reviewing the documents, and a lot of documents would become declassified. So yes, I mean, it depends how many of those relate to crash retrievals. I don't know how many of them will, if any, but it would be a huge development and it would certainly move us more towards, I think, an acceptance by the mainstream, because that's the kind of thing they always want: official documentation, official statements. It's all got to come from government. So I do think you're right. I think that panel could help a lot towards engaging the mainstream media at a new level. We've had phases like in the spring of 21. I don't know if you remember, it was just before the first ODNI report came out. Mm-hmm. The media was just going berserk and every media was covering it then. I don't know if you remember, it was all before that report came out in June of 2021. The previous April and May of that year, I mean, everybody and their brother in the media was covering this and they couldn't get enough of it. And that's when the 60 Minutes stories came out. That's when the New Yorker story came out. And, you know, ABC and all the television networks were covering this. And then the report came out and they didn't really do much afterwards. But there's these bursts of media activity in which they all get engaged and there has to be something to sort of set them off. And in 21, it was the anticipation of that report coming out. So the Schumer Amendment could be another trigger like that, depending on what comes out of it once it passes. And we'll see what comes out of that if it does pass.
Yeah, that makes sense. Looking forward to 2024, you know, coming into this year, we had heard rumblings that 2023 was going to be the biggest year since 2017. And I think it definitely delivered on that. What are you going to be looking for in 2024 as we move forward as those kinds of inflection points where we might be seeing some more interest from the media?
Well, it'll, of course, be whatever happens with Schumer, whatever kind of amendment is passed with the NDA. If anything comes out of that, that will certainly be the first step in next year. And then, you know, hopefully there will be more hearings. I mean, there've already been talk of that. And at the Seoul conference, Admiral Tim Gallaudet referenced the fact that I think it was Representative Luna told him that she wanted to hold a hearing focused on underwater UFO events. I mean, he did say that at the conference. So there's a lot of conversations going on about possible hearings. Maybe there will be more whistleblowers coming forward, as we discussed earlier. And then, you know, I think the projects like the Galileo Project and the Seoul Foundation are going to be doing a lot next year. Galileo is going to continue with its research and its explorations of the retrieval of various materials. And Seoul is going to be putting out a lot of papers, holding additional conferences. So there's a lot that people can do outside of government also. And I think it's all going to happen.
Speaking of the Seoul Foundation conference, so lovely to see you there. And it was such a wonderful time. Could you talk a little bit for listeners who might not be familiar with what the Seoul Foundation is up to and what the vision is there?
Yeah. So the Soul Foundation, again, I'm not a spokesperson for the Soul Foundation, and they do have a website. So I would encourage everyone to go look at that website, which describes more eloquently than I can what their mission is. But in a nutshell, they're basically a kind of a think tank that's been put together by Gary Nolan and Peter Skafish to try and influence policy, to try to write policy papers and provide information to those making policy decisions who need background information, who need to become informed about certain things. So they really want to play a role in the political, the world, and potentially the scientific world as well, to play a role in affecting how the policy is developed. And it's to really call together and bring together the most credible, important voices in the dialogue. And that's what they did at their conference. I mean, the level of people that were there was just really spectacular. And the high level of the talks that were given, I've never been to anything like it before. So I think it's also an effort to bring together, to pull together some of the best minds in the field from the academic community too. It's very focused on accessing people from the academic world to just contribute to the dialogue more and to help influence policy so that more credibility can be brought to it. That's how I would describe it. But again, people should go look at the website.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. I was so inspired by what I saw at Seoul and really heartened by it. I will say, though, that one of the things that struck me while I was at Seoul, because of the way it was set up with it being a little bit more private and they didn't want people sharing out information, which all made good sense, especially once people did share out information. And I feel like a lot of that misinformation was immediately misinterpreted. But what struck me at Seoul was how far the narrative of disclosure that you find online is from the reality of the conversations that are being had by the people who are actually involved in doing the work and doing some of the decision making. Like, you know, you mentioned Tim Gallaudet, he was incredible to hear from, and Carl Nell. And you hear these people who are used to dealing with kind of the biggest, scariest questions that we put in front of the members of our intelligence community and our military, and having to like really reckon with those things. I was hoping you might just be able to, I don't know if there's a question in there, but if just speak a little bit to some of the ways that what we refer to as disclosure is just so much more complicated than it's presented in the online narrative, where it's all about just, you know, we demand answers now. It seems like we're missing some serious nuance there.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I'm not that aware of what is going on online regarding, you know, what you're referring to, but
a wise woman.
Yeah, okay. But I think it is a really, really complicated decision about how to go about it and what the impact is going to be and what the resistance is all about and how to think about it. What kind of policy should be in place? What should it be, gradual? Should it be fast? I mean, and the impact that it could have on society, which is something that's been discussed for decades behind the scenes. What's the best way to do it? So I think it is really complicated. It depends too on where the people considering it, what their background is. I mean, everybody's background leads them to a different kind of perspective on it. And it's so incredible to bring all those perspectives together in a forum like Seoul, which is what happened. So yeah, it's really not as simple as, oh, we just deserve to know everything. I mean, even Tim Burchett from Tennessee, the member of Congress who's so outspoken on this, has a kind of simplistic approach to it. I think he's a great guy and everything, but you know, he just says, oh, it's a cover up. Everybody should know everything. And I respect the need for I like the idea, actually, of a sort of controlled disclosure, which is what the Schumer Amendment's trying to do. I mean, maybe 10 years is a little too slow. And I think if that amendment passed as it was set up, it would not take 10 years, even though it was sort of allowing for that. But I think it's important to think carefully about it and manage how it's done and think about the impact it's going to have on the world. And do we work with other countries on this? If there is an announcement, should it be something shared with other countries to do that? You know, all these kinds of questions that need to be asked. Is it a positive thing? Could it bring us together as a planetary civilization, which is what some people like Avi Loh and even Chris Mellon was saying that at the Seoul conference. Some people have that approach, that it's something that could unify us as a civilization. Other people think it could have the opposite effect. because we'd all fight over the technology. And that all it really matters is whoever gets the technology dominates everything. And that's all we're going to care about. And so there's so many different viewpoints on it, Kelly. I mean, you probably noticed that even at the conference. And so I think that's why it's important to have the conversation so that all of that can be listened to and heard and thought about. And we can kind of maybe move into a more unified kind of perception of how it should all unfold. But you've got to take into account so many different perspectives and thoughts and concerns about how it all happens, how it all should happen. So that's my perspective on it. I don't claim to have the answers at all. I just want to listen to what everybody has to say and try to learn about it and think about it.
I completely agree. I feel like I had an understanding that it was more complicated than I thought, but Sol was really helpful for that. And I'm excited for when those videos hopefully go live at some point for people to hopefully dig in and really listen, because I think some really important conversations were had that took this conversation to a different level. And I was really encouraged to see that. I thought it was great.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I thought was so interesting too, was so special about it, was that everybody, the whole conference started with the agreed upon premise that this is a real phenomenon. And I think I would even be willing to say that it was agreed upon by the speakers that this is a non-human phenomenon, that non-human intelligence is a real thing. I don't think any of those speakers would have disagreed with that, even if they didn't state it directly. It was way beyond the sort of earlier conferences that involve people like this, where it would deal with trying to prove that it's real, right? They didn't get the feeling that we just were now at a level where everybody kind of agrees as to this is a non-human phenomenon, it's non-human intelligence, and we don't even have to discuss anymore whether that's true or not, because we all agree that that's true. And so to be able to jump off of that as a platform rather than having to debate that was, to me, really incredible when you consider the level that the speakers were at and the involvement, different levels of involvement that they have, you know, that didn't have to be debated. I thought that was really, really, but shows how far we've come.
That was amazing. And I completely agree. It makes for such a more productive conversation when you can just sort of get to it and not always have to be speaking to the lowest common denominator, the most skeptical person in the room.
I agree. And everybody seemed to be on the same page. And think about where we would have been with that, even after the New York Times story, you know? I mean, how long have we been in that kind of a place? Not too long, I don't think. So that, to me, was just a wonderful thing to see.
It was. And I think it's so good to celebrate those wins, because it can be hard, I think, when we're in it, to see them as they pop up. I know that, like, one question that already I saw sort of bubbling up at Sol and that continues to be raised within the community is just how experiencers fit into the current push for disclosure. It seems like the language and the legislation around disclosure, for really practical reasons that make a lot of sense, does seem to focus on craft and tech and, like, occasionally bodies, but we never really seem to acknowledge that there are many, many people who claim to already be interacting with non-human intelligences on this planet. It seems like that's hopefully the next break that we'll get in the conversation. But what do you make of where we are in the conversation with regard to experiencers right now?
I think that's such an important point, Kelly. I mean, I understand why the mainstream narrative and the dialogue with members of Congress really can't go there at this point. They just can't bring it in. There's not enough hard data related to it. And there should be more people in universities doing studies on experiencers. And of course, we do have people like Diana Pasulka and Jeff Kripal that write about these. I mean, Diana's new book, Encounters, is dealing with experiencers of a certain type. And so I think we're moving more in that direction, but I know exactly what you're saying. And it's always been painful to me because my heart goes out to the experiencers. I know so many of them. I respect them highly. And what they've experienced is extremely important. But it's not something, you know, that I could ever hope to publish on at this point. I mean, I know Ralph Blumenthal did a really good story, and it was supposed to be in the New York Times, and there was a whole problem with it not getting in. So I think we're making progress, as you say. And I really thought it was also really important to note that Whitley Strieber was at this whole Foundation conference, and he raised twice, he pretty much raised the question that you just raised which is, you know, to challenge these speakers about bringing that into the dialogue more. Why can't we do that? Why isn't that happening? And how can we do it? How can we incorporate the realm of experiencers into the narrative better than we've done so far? And I don't think anybody had an answer to that at the conference. Maybe they're not concerned about it enough, but I also think it is sort of, you know, it's difficult to do that if you're trying to do things like get legislation passed. I think you have to look between the lines too and try to, again, I'm trying to be more positive about it. The fact that the legislation in the last couple of years has included requests from the ODNI, requests for things like psychological impacts on people and medical effects on people, those two things open up the door to experiencers as far as I see it. I see that as a connection to the world of experiencers. And so if there were cases that could be brought forward in which experiencers have documented medical effects, for instance, that could be something that could be brought more into the mainstream, or some kind of psychological study done by, you know, about how consciousness is affected by it, done by someone at a university. I mean, we kind of have to move in that direction. And I would really like to see that happen. And I think a lot of other people would too. It's a matter of finding our way there in a way that keeps the dialogue going at the level that it's at now. And I think even, you know, some of the things that Gresh talked about even sort of crossed a line. I think we just have to be careful about crossing a line too soon, because if we do that, it can backfire and be a setback, and we just have to take it one step at a time. So, I mean, I really, really agree with you, and I would love nothing more than to try to find a way to incorporate it more. And I think it will happen over time. I mean, I don't know how you feel. You've interviewed Jeff Kripal, and you know Diana Basalka. As somebody who's involved with the experiencer group, I don't know. I think that their work obviously is sort of opening a door for all the experiencers and, you know, legitimizing all of it and pointing out why it's important for us to pay attention to it. I guess that's what Jeff does. These experiences are real. They happen to lots of people, and we have to pay attention to them. He makes that point beautifully. So I don't know. I don't know what else to say except that I understand the difficulty of it, especially for the experiencers. And I'm glad that Whitley made those points at the conference. And I hope that people will think about what Whitley was saying. And I hope his statements were recorded and people can hear them, because I think they were really, really important. And I hope that when things are released, one of the things that can be released are the comments that he made.
I hope so too. I told Whitley after that I thought it was one of the most important points of the conference. And like you, I don't know what the right answer is. And I can see how complex it is. But I felt like it was a really important moment to have such high-level members of the military and intelligence community present and talking on these issues seriously, and to have Whitley there as that voice of the experiencer side of things. I thought it was clear that there was no real easy answer in how we connect those two different perspectives, but the fact that the conversation was raised and in such an important place, I thought was really important. And I think it also kind of puts the onus on the rest of us, you know, in the community to help acclimate the world a little bit more to experiencer narratives and to their situation. Because, you know, I think what's clear is that the intelligence community is probably not going to lead the way on that.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right. They're not. No, it's going to have to be a more humanistic. I mean, that's what Jeff's trying to do, is sort of bring it into the world of the humanities. And maybe that's where it's got to start.
I completely agree. And I think that's a great segue to talk about something that you'll be doing this coming week in New York City. You're going to be co-hosting the next meeting of the Inquiry into Anomalous Experience and the Phenomenon Conference Series this Saturday, mm-hmm. December 9th in New York City. Can you talk a little bit about what makes this conference series so special and why you chose to get involved?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's so special about this conference, it's kind of along the lines of what you're talking about, is that it covers all the whole full range of anomalous experience. So that doesn't even have to only be UFOs, of course, all kinds of anomalous experience. And by bringing them into one location and one conference, it's trying to show the interconnections between the different experiences, and at the same time, having people from government talking about, you know, the more nuts and bolts aspects of this, like more like the Soul Foundation, but on the same platform, having people dealing with anomalous kind of weirder things or personal experience, questions about how to interpret what the non-human intelligence might be. It's very open-ended, and it kind of has this huge umbrella of anomalous experience. And we try to have, like, every conference, a really diverse group of people that can bring a perspective to it that is very wide and covers a lot of different phenomena. And I think the goal is to really try to get more understanding about how all of it interconnects. So I just love that about this. I love the fact that the conference is very small and there's a lot of time for Q&A. So there's a lot of interaction that goes on between the audience and the speakers, a lot of dialoguing that goes on. And that I like about it as well. And I love working with Jay King, who's been great. We're now partners in this, and I just love working with him. And it's inspiring to me to try to bring together people that are all open and understand this anomalous world from their own different perspectives and kind of try to combine it all. So I think that's how I see it. People can still join on the live stream. And the people joining on the live stream also get to ask questions. So they're not excluded just because they're not in the room. They're very much incorporated into the Q&A part of the conference.
That's so great. This is by far my favorite conference to go to. I've been to two of the three. The one that I missed, I immediately regretted missing. But yeah, I can't wait. I think it's a really special place. And for anybody who can't make it this time, there's a live stream option. And in the future, I think it's one that's really worth making the trip for all the reasons you talked about, Leslie. It's just very intimate and it's really forward thinking. And so you have the opportunity to have really cool conversations with really interesting people. And I just can't say enough good things about it. I can't wait.
I know. And there are a lot of experiencers that come to this conference because they know this is like a family for them. You know, that's a big part of the audience. For people that have experiences, it's just a wonderful, warm environment for them. And they're fully welcomed and fully respected. And they're part of the dialogue. It's part of what goes on in that conference. So that's sort of an element, I think, that we incorporate that something like the Soul Foundation is not able to incorporate. And I don't fault them for that. It's just not appropriate for them to do that right now. But this conference can do that. And we have some of the same people we have two people at this conference who were at Soul, that Tim Gallaudet and Diana Pasulka are both going to be there. So these people do cross over. We've had Gary Nolan in the past. I mean, we've had Chris Mellon. They cross over among these different worlds. So it's trying to bring the whole anomalous world together. And that's what I do. I love it. It's very friendly and warm and conversational. So I can't wait.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's great. You know, I have the pleasure of working with Jay as well. And he's just such an eminently talented person. And I think one of his great gifts among many is connecting people. And I think he started something pretty special. And that this is kind of like a natural extension of that.
He's a natural. And we also have a special guest that wasn't on our program initially, who's Alex Dietrich, the pilot who was involved with the Tic Tac incident along with Dave Praber. She's going to be coming at the conference as our surprise guest. It seems like every conference, somebody ends up getting added at the last minute who's like a surprise guest. And we've had that again with her. So that's exciting too.
Oh, I can't wait for that. That's going to be so wonderful. Well, before we move on to other topics, I had one question that I had put on Twitter asking people what questions they had for you. And there was one question that people asked far more than any others. I'm sure you can probably even guess what it is. But I wanted to give you a chance to respond. You had made some brief comments in the past about maybe not having the most optimism for the future, specifically when asked about rumors where there's potentially something big coming in 2027, around that time frame. Could you say a little bit more about that? People are just very curious as to what your thinking is there. And I think a lot of people have read into a lot of what you said. And so I wanted to give you the chance to comment.
Yeah. Thanks, Kelly. I think at the time I did that interview, I had been studying a lot about climate change and also the political world situation, which we're now seeing, of course, getting worse and worse. I tend to think that we're going to face some really hard times in the future, and we could have another major war. And, you know, I think the climate change thing is extremely serious and maybe worse than other people might think it is. I think it's going to happen faster than maybe other people think. But again, it's just my opinion. I don't see into the future. I don't have any special real knowledge. I think at that time I was talking to people within the intelligence community, some of whom have very kind of pessimistic opinions about what's going to happen in the future. But since then, my perspective has shifted a little bit. I'm more hopeful. And I feel much more like I really don't know what's going to happen. Maybe there will be technology developed that can help deal with climate change. Who knows? Maybe the NHI will even intervene. I think part of the discussion has been, will they intervene to help us, or will they? Do they just not care? And maybe they'll just be tired of us and want us to go away and preserve the planet for themselves. I mean, there's all these theories around what role this other species might play in the future of this planet as we humans are gradually destroying the planet, basically, and fighting and polluting and causing species to go extinct and all the things we're doing. So when I put all that together, I can sometimes get very concerned about it. But I think I feel now more like there may be more possibilities of something happening to redirect it or help us shift in some way. But it's going to have to be something big, Kelly. So I don't know, but I just don't want people to focus on that statement as if I have some kind of secret knowledge of something that I'm not telling them. We all have to contribute towards doing whatever we can to try to create as positive a world as we can and try to address the problems that we face. And that's all we can do. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. So I think a lot of it is about how we think and how we orient ourselves. And that's what we have to think about, is just orient ourselves in a certain way to be positive and to try to create change. And that's all we can do.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to clarify on that. I don't know if you've read the book. Have you read the book, The Fourth Turning?
No, I haven't.
It's an interesting book. I recommend it to people all the time. The author's names are Strauss and Howe. And they wrote this book back in the late 90s. That was based on generational theory and working through kind of a study of the various generations in the United States in particular. And they ended up coming upon this pattern that seems to repeat in about 80 to 100 year cycles that culminates in a crisis, and then things fall apart. And then we kind of have this reawakening of collaboration and civic duty and that sort of thing. And then slowly people get more and more disillusioned. And then we have this big crisis. And wouldn't you know it, we right now are coming up on what is supposed to be this sort of generational crisis point that happens. And so I do wonder, I think maybe part of the reason people feel such concern when they hear ideas like that is because we all have this innate sense that we're coming upon a big challenge as a people. But I think the good news that I take out of it, at least, is that after these big challenges, we tend to really pull it together and start behaving better than we were before the big challenge. So, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm optimistic.
Yes, I hope you're right. I mean, with climate change, it's a little harder to imagine that, because once certain damage is done, there's no undoing it.
Right.
But nonetheless, we might have some damage and then still, as you're saying, adjust and do something positive that kind of takes us to another level. So yeah, everything happens in cycles. I really believe that. So it's a good perspective to have. I'll get that book. Sounds like a good book.
It's very interesting. So to switch gears a little bit, I got a lot of questions on this topic as well, because on top of your work investigating UFOs, you also wrote an incredible book called Surviving Death, which was then also turned into a wonderful docuseries in which you investigated evidence for the afterlife. It seems like there are a lot of people who have this sort of dual fascination with UFOs and near-death experiences or the afterlife. Why do you think that is? And do you see there being a connection between those two areas of study?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the reason people are interested in all of it is because it's all anomalous phenomena. It's all the world of the mysterious and the kind of realities that go beyond our five senses and our material world. And once you go into that realm, one thing is going to lead you to another, because they're all at some level interconnected. I think two of the biggest questions are we alone in the universe? And what happens after we die? Does our consciousness survive death? And so I think a lot of people who are interested in one of those questions will also be interested in the other question. And it's just natural for certain types of people to be open to all of it. And I think That's what happens to me. It happened to me, certainly, after studying UFOs and reporting on UFOs for so many years. I had the opportunity to do a second book, and it just seemed like the natural topic that I wanted to look into next was this question of survival of consciousness. And not that I had spent all the amount of time on it that I'd spent on UFOs. This book was very different in that it took a shorter amount of time. And I'd spent 10 years on UFOs before I did my book on UFOs in 2010. So I've kind of been exploring some of the topics for many years that I did write about in Surviving Death, but not in the same way. It was just very different. So it just seemed to me like a natural segue. And I think probably for a lot of people, experiences that people have seem to cross worlds with the world of some kind of afterlife or some kind of other dimension that could include near-death experiences and UFOs, maybe in the same kind of interdimensional space.
Yeah, absolutely. It all seems to come back to questions about, like, in exploring non-human intelligence or non-conventionally human intelligence or the dead and all of these other ideas, we're ultimately asking the big questions about who we are and why we're here.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think particularly with Surviving Death, it deals with really the question of consciousness. And I think with UFOs too, the question is, how does our consciousness affect what we are perceiving and what we are experiencing with regards to the UFO phenomenon? How much does it help create what we're experiencing? And what is the role of consciousness in all of this? And that connects to UFOs, even though I don't discuss UFOs in the book, but it's all about what is the power of consciousness? What can consciousness create? And is it something that you can imagine would just disappear when our physical body dies? And so I'm making a lot of arguments for the likelihood that consciousness does survive death in that book. And I was trying to be as journalistic as I always am, except I did include some of my own personal experiences in the book, which is somewhat of a risk for a reporter to do, but I did it. And when I was writing Surviving Death, Kelly, I really wasn't thinking about UFOs or about there being any connection, really. It was so interesting to me that I wasn't thinking about that connection at all. I thought of them at that time as being totally different topics. And the Surviving Death book came out in 2017. It was the same year as the New York Times, only a lot earlier in the year. And it was only after it came out that I really started to think of that interconnection. But while I was writing it, I wasn't thinking about it at all. Just, I find that kind of interesting. My perspective has grown so much by the influence that I've had from great thinkers like Jeff Kripal and Diana and other people who I've spoken to. And the interconnection has become much clearer to me. Also, people like Colm Kelleher, some of the things that happened at Skinwalker Ranch, which sort of cross these boundaries between consciousness and just weird things that happen that aren't really UFO and aren't really something else. You don't know what they are, but they're all kind of in one universe.
As you went to go about researching for this book, how do you as a journalist think about approaching the evidence for the survival of consciousness after death? Because that's probably something that's a little, has a lot of complications in investigating it, I'm sure. So how did you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, it was way more difficult for me than writing my book on UFOs, which came out in 2010. Just so much more difficult because there's not like physical evidence. It's just not as concrete. It's not as nuts and bolts as UFOs. So I was trying to find the most evidential cases, of course. And I would look at papers written by medical doctors, psychiatrists, people from the Division of Perceptual Studies at University of Virginia, anything that had some authority behind it. There are medical doctors who've been working with studying near-death experiences and people that had a kind of authority, just like we're trying to do with UFOs, trying to bring these authoritative voices forward. So a lot of it was going that route and then trying to find, for instance, like in the realm of the cases of reincarnation, which are the most evidential cases, which are the ones that are just so hard to dismiss that you really can't explain them any other way. And so I just focused on those. I mean, I just took the best evidence from all these different areas of exploration. And then I also, to whatever extent I could explore it on my own, I did. So if I wanted to find out, for instance, if mediumship, there's anything to it, because a lot of people just think it's all bogus, I just decided I'm going to go sit down with and have what they call a reading with some of the best mediums I can find, and I'll find out for myself if it's valid or not. You can test some of this stuff on your own, by jumping into it, which you can't do with UFOs. You can't decide that I'm going to have a UFO show up outside my window and maybe I can interact with it. So I did that to whatever extent I could, which was really mind-blowing for me. There's nothing like personal experience, as all the experiencers know, to really convince you of things. So that was an element for me too, but it was so sort of combining research and also looking at historical research. There's a lot of amazing work done around the turn of the century in the early 1900s on with top level scientists who studied mediumship and published papers on it, books on it. And these were like Nobel Prize winning, very reputable scientists who just were able to isolate these mediums from any possible fraudulent activity and document what they were able to do in very controlled situations. And so I was very interested too in bringing forward the kind of research that most people don't know even exists, which scientists today aren't interested in doing or find difficult to do for a lot of reasons. But back in the early part of the, and in the early 1900s, there were a lot of scientists making these tremendously interesting studies. And there were mediums around that were willing to subject themselves to the kind of harsh conditions that were required for these scientists to do the studies. And so I was really excited about bringing those papers forward in my book so people would know that there's real scientific data behind this. And just like with any other topic, you try to find the best sources you can, the best studies you can. You try to find evidence that's been verified in various different ways and put it to the test of journalism. And it's hard to do that with a topic like this, but I think I was able to find some pretty compelling information to bring forward. And it was a really, really fascinating journey to go on and to do that.
Yeah, I absolutely loved the book. And I just had this great conversation with Dean Radin, chief scientist over at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And it's so striking to me that with so many different kind of anomalous and psi phenomena, that we have actually so much really strong evidence and scholarship and science that's been done around these things that the people tend to be just unaware of because it just generally just gets ignored as being quackery of some kind. But in a lot of cases, what you find is that the controls that have been set up around these experiments are so rigid because of all of the different funny business that can go on. Some of these experiments end up being more bulletproof than just about anything you'd see in a science lab. So along those lines, once you dug into the evidence for survival of consciousness after death, where do you feel like we shake out on that? Like, how strong do you think the evidence is?
Well, the way I left it in the book was I thought it was highly suggestive. You know, there's no way to prove it. But I was combining evidence from so many different areas of study. And so I just felt like when you put all that together, it's all pointing at the same thing, even though the studies are all completely independent and even in completely different areas of research. And that's how I stated it in the book. I wanted to be as objective as possible. I'm not going to make any claims that I've been able to prove it because I haven't. And look at it and think, well, it's pretty suggestive and it's pretty likely that we do survive death. You'd have to find ways of writing off so many different things and finding counter explanations for so many different interesting things that would be hard to do. And I think by reporting on the work of many, many people who have been working on this, that the fact that consciousness can operate independently of the body, I would say is pretty clearly a fact. I mean, that's really been established through so many different ways. The question really is, does that same thing happen when we lose our physical bodies? I'm talking about being able to demonstrate that consciousness can separate itself from a living body that can operate independently of the way we understand the brain and what the brain is supposed to be able to do. That's pretty clear. So whether we can take that to the complete loss of the physical body and show that the same thing will happen, that's again, speculation, really. We don't know for sure. And again, the role that personal experience plays for everyone has a huge effect on what you're going to believe about this and what you feel like you know about this. It's just so personal. It's not always objective, and that's just the way it has to be. But I tried to provide as much objective information as I could.
Yeah, but I'd really encourage people to read it because it is challenging if it's counter to your worldview. But I think what strikes me in it, and not just in your book, but in so much work that has to do with psi phenomena and UFOs and everything else. Like, in some ways, I hate to break out just one piece of it or one story because it just opens it up to so much criticism without context. But one thing that I really enjoyed and that I found myself thinking about going back to after reading your book is this idea that, just as an example, that a lot of these mediums, especially like in physical mediumship, that this takes place in the dark. And it seems that there's a lot of evidence that you almost need to be in darkness for a lot of these different phenomena associated with physical mediumship to manifest themselves. And I think that's just such a great example to me of something that if you don't believe in this at all, that darkness is suddenly like a red flag. It's like, oh, well, there must be some sort of trickery going on here. And like, well, of course they'd want to do it in the dark. And yet, as somebody who has spent more time really investigating the weirder side of anomalous phenomena, it actually, in a lot of ways, makes sense to me that the darkness would potentially be like I can understand a framework in which that makes sense. In the same way that anomalous phenomena tend to happen in the middle of the night when most people are sleeping, that it happens in these kind of liminal spaces, and there's a lot of liminality associated with these kinds of phenomena. There's just all these kinds of other hints that maybe we're dealing with just something about the structure of reality that we don't quite understand yet. And yet it's also something that makes it so easy then for people to turn around and just say, well, this is all just a hoax or something that somebody's making
up. Yeah, no, that is a really tricky component of it. You're absolutely right. And I, having sat with this one medium for so many years, I understand the element of the dark. But I also need to say that there are phenomena that go on in the light. And this gentleman's name is Stuart Alexander. He's a physical medium in the UK who I've studied and worked with for a lot of years and know very well. And the phenomena in his seance room are not always in the dark. So it's a mixture, but some of them are. And it's just the way it is. And it's always been like that. And throughout history, some physical mediums require more darkness than others. But there's plenty of phenomena that have occurred and been documented that occur in the light. They're absolutely mind-blowing. So, yeah, I mean, the skeptics will love to, oh, it's all in the dark. Forget it. They're all, you know, it's not all in the dark. And it's not simple as to why it sometimes is in the dark. So you're right. It is a problem. But so many of the people who criticize it for that are just completely uninformed about, first of all, that it's not all in the dark. And second of all, about why it might be needed, why the darkness might be needed, why it might be important. I don't think they really want to think about that and ask that question. And so there we are. But I've witnessed things myself that with my eyes that are not in the dark. So there, it's not always like that. And same thing through history.
Absolutely. Well, I'd really encourage people to read the book if they haven't already. I know a lot of people have, but it's absolutely fascinating. One final question, Leslie, I'd love to ask before we sign off is whether it's through, you know, UFOs and disclosure or this kind of growing awareness that there's something going on with the nature of our reality and consciousness, this sort of huge paradigm shift that seems to be upon us. It seems like there's more and more people every day who just want to get involved and who want to find a way to help, and many of whom aren't sure where to start. And I was just wondering if you have any recommendations for people who are really feeling called to get more involved or to just understand all of this more deeply. Where would you recommend that people start with that?
I would say probably reading some of the more classic books on the topic, becoming acquainted with some of the lead thinkers. I'm thinking of someone like Jacques Vallée, who's been around for decades thinking and writing about this, and just becoming more knowledgeable about it. But in terms of becoming active, I mean, gosh, you probably know more than I do, Kelly, because you're like on Twitter and I'm not. I don't know if that's the place for people to join the community, but they might want to become more activists. And maybe it depends what people are interested in. If they want to try to influence their members of Congress, of course, that's always a really good thing to do. I just think it's so great that people want to become involved. And all I can do is just sort of think of some great books for them to read and talk to people, come to conferences, listen to podcasts, you know, become part of this community the best way that you can. And maybe you could shed more light on that than I can about, you know, how people can become involved with a community that's out there.
Yeah. I mean, something that we touched on even in our conversation a little earlier is just that there does seem to be this need for people in the humanities and also for people just to help get other people acclimated to this kind of new world. It seems like there's more opportunities than ever for people, whether if you're an artist or if you've got some other kind of a skill set. If you start connecting with people in the community, that you'll find opportunities, I think, to get involved, because I think that this is opening up now. It's not just about demanding the government to give us answers. We're kind of moving forward. Like you were saying, it's soul, you know, these conversations are being had with a lot more seriousness. And I feel like we've only just begun to understand what sort of opportunities and needs that there's going to be as we move through this, you know, paradigm shift.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, people can join the conversations. People can try to engage with these organizations. Also Galileo projects. I'm sure there's the SCU, the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. That's what it is, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Which is a group of PhDs who are studying this. And Ryan Graves has an Aviation Safety Foundation. I mean, there's all these incredible civilian organizations that have sprung to life in the last few years. And I'm sure a lot of them have ways for people to become involved, to support those organizations, to contribute, and just engage, meeting people through them, and also just conferences, podcasts, groups like the Experiencer Group. For anybody who has had any kind of anomalous experience, especially if it's troubling for them, I would highly recommend the Experiencer Group from what I understand of it. I'm not experienced, so I'm not part of that group, but from what I understand of that group, it has been so helpful to people. It's a community of fellow experiencers, so you don't have to be isolated alone with your experience that nobody else understands. I'm sure there are more than what I've thought of, and I'm sorry I've left anybody out, but it's not just about government. You're absolutely right. There's so many civilian groups and individuals out there that are making great contributions, and people can connect with those groups and hopefully find a way in to become part of all of it.
Absolutely. I love that. Well, Leslie, thank you so, so much for joining me today on the show. It is such an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you. And so thanks for making the time.
Thank you for having me, Kelly. And I look forward to seeing you on Saturday at the conference.